Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, we now have our presenters in conference. Participation in this presentation is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law. Please disconnect from the call or log off the webinar if the AHA did not expressly invite your participation. Please also be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. During today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions or comments. At that time, instructions will be given as the procedure to follow if you'd like to ask a question or to give a comment. It is now my pleasure to turn this conference over to Julia Resnick. You may begin.
Great. Thank you so much, Chantal, and welcome everyone to today's virtual workshop, Community Collaborations and Medical Integration, Effectively Addressing Substance Use Disorders. I'm Julia Resnick, Senior Program Manager with the Value Initiative for the American Hospital Association. I'm joined by my colleague, Rebecca Chickie, Director of Field Engagement with our Section for Psychiatric and Substance Abuse Services. This webinar is a collaboration between our two groups at the American Hospital Association. We're so glad you have joined us today to discuss the important topics of how community collaborations and medical integration of behavioral health improve value for individuals and communities. Before jumping in, let me take a minute to share some of the work we are doing at the AHA. Over the past 2 years, AHA has devoted significant new resources to thinking about affordability and value. In 2017, the AHA launched the Value Initiative, recognizing that we could not wait for others to take the lead on affordability. It is our responsibility to take on a leadership role in this space. So we are looking at affordability through the lens of value, because we know that making healthcare more affordable requires more than just reducing the cost of care. And while there is no standard definition of value across the healthcare field today, the AHA defines value as part of an equation that includes cost, outcomes, and the patient experience. So, outcomes, patient experience, and cost. Those are complex concepts that are impacted by many factors. These can be broken down into four basic value-based strategies, including redesigning the delivery system, improving quality and outcomes, managing risk and offering new payment models, and implementing operational solutions. The breadth of these strategies suggests a key point, that everyone and every part of the healthcare system is part of the value equation. The Value Initiative provides thought leadership to the hospital field on the issues of affordability and value. We are providing our members with education, resources, and tools to advance affordable healthcare and promote value within our communities. You can learn more about our work at aha.org/thevalueinitiative. We also provide in-person educational programming through our regional executive forums throughout the year. The next one is coming up on May 9th in Atlanta. And our collaboration with AHA Section for Psychiatric and Substance Abuse Services will continue beyond this webinar to explore how hospitals are addressing the behavioral health needs of their communities to improve value. I encourage you to register for our future webinars at aha.org/behavioralhealth, and the link will be available at the end of the presentation. Before we really jump in, we have some quick housekeeping announcements. Today's program includes an interactive Q&A section. If you have a question at any time during the webinar, please type it in the Q&A section on the right section of your screen. You can also download today's presentation under Files. At the conclusion of the webinar, you'll see a brief evaluation pop up on your screen. Please take a minute to complete the evaluation so that we can continue to serve you better with future educational programs. Now, let me introduce our speakers for today. With me are our two distinguished presenters. Dr. Daniel Duhigg is the Medical Director for Behavioral Health at Presbyterian Medical Group, part of Presbyterian Health Services in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And Brenda Romero is the Hospital Chief Executive at Presbyterian Española Hospital. And she is a new member of AHA's Psych Council. Now let's dive right into the substance of this workshop. Brenda and Daniel, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, and good morning, everybody. This is Dan Duhigg, and as was said in the introduction, I'm a physician, and I'm an addiction psychiatrist and lead our behavioral health group in our medical group here at Presbyterian Healthcare Services. And over the last few years, we have been working on what we call the Integrated Substance Use Disorder and Community Collaborative Initiative for a pretty long title. But we chose the title because it really gets at the depth and kind of breadth of how we're trying to address substance use disorders across New Mexico. So I want to share with you some of what we've done in this initiative. It really is, and has been from the start, a collaborative effort with Presbyterian Healthcare Services, which includes a delivery system across the state, as well as the Presbyterian Health Plan, which is an insurance carrier that covers and offers both Medicaid, or what we call Centennial services, in our state of New Mexico, as well as a variety of commercial products. And so the healthcare delivery system and the healthcare insurance plan work together. We've also worked with the state through the Behavioral Health Services Division, as well as the community in general, and that's really been key to our approach. We were funded by the state in 2016 to create innovative programs and approaches to substance use disorder treatment, many of which we'll share with you today. And really what we knew from the start is that what we needed to do is take a population health approach. And this is, on the one hand, thinking about populations as a whole, but also interventions on the community and population level, and trying to use data as much as possible and where it's available to guide some of these decisions. And really making an integrated approach, integrating with specialty services and with primary care, and encouraging evidence-based practices. What we decided and realized from the start, because like many places and systems that many of you may be a part of, in New Mexico we have a real workforce shortage when it comes to psychiatric providers and behavioral health. And so from the start, our position was that the answer, the solution to addressing substance use disorders should not lie exclusively within behavioral health, that really these patients are seen everywhere in our system. They're seen in primary care, they're seen in specialty care, they're seen in emergency departments and in hospitals and in the outpatient setting. And so really what we have done is essentially to say that addiction treatment or the treatment of substance use disorders is not a specialty. It's something that everybody needs to do. And so our emphasis really has been on trying to educate as many people as possible, not only to think differently about patients living with substance use disorders, but also what each individual's role is in that overall treatment. So this has really been a process of changing the culture, starting with the fundamental of cultivating compassion and a non-judgmental approach to people through things like addressing stigma. And educating people about addictions as a chronic medical condition, and then presenting them with, you know, here's what we know about evidence-based practice. So it's not a treatment center. This isn't an inpatient program per se. It's really an approach that we are disseminating across the enterprise, which I think has a lot more staying power. And certainly a much more robust effect on not only the patients that we serve, but also on our workforce, because people really like to connect with compassion and what they got into healthcare to do initially. And what we've seen is just a really positive response amongst our providers and our administrators in terms of not feeling helpless about addressing substance use disorders, instead feeling empowered and feeling really good about the work that they're doing. So there are a couple key interventions that I want to briefly share with you. It is predicated on our mission and our vision here, and the mission really is to improve the physical and mental health status of people who are living with substance use disorders, but really by creating this system of care that provides high-quality treatment and interventions, and then really focusing on seamless transitions between settings of care and the recovery community as a whole. And really using evidence-based approaches, as I've said, with a focus on quality of life, also on harm reduction, which we know is so important. If we can lower recidivism for example, with inappropriate or poorly matched use of healthcare resources, as well as things like in the criminal justice system, then certainly we have achieved a better health. And if we can reduce costs overall for our system, for our patients, and for society, then we have achieved the quadruple aim here. So just to tell you a little bit about Presbyterian, so the Presbyterian healthcare services, the delivery system, serves about 758,000 patients annually. So this is about a third of the population of our state of New Mexico. We're a very large state, but a very rural state. Our health plan, our insurance, covers about 475,000 members. But our system really sees everybody. So our delivery system sees people with Presbyterian health insurance, but we also see everybody else, other commercial insurances and other Medicare and Medicaid coverage as well. We have 12 patient-centered medical homes and 22 integrated primary care clinics where we have embedded behavioralists as well. So we have quite an opportunity here. Now, this is an overall view of the interventions with the Integrated Substance Use Disorder and Community Collaborative Initiative. And we're going to take a tour of some of these and look more in depth at what specifically each of these programs is trying to achieve. But we can always reference this 30,000-foot view, or what we call the snowflake, if we need to. So first and foremost, you know, we really focus on community partnerships. And as we're talking to folks on this webinar across the country, you know, what I want to emphasize is that this is not like a type of approach. This whole initiative is not something that requires millions of dollars to do. Really, what we wanted to build was something that is sustainable and scalable, and achievable not only for us in New Mexico, where we are a very poor state, but really anywhere in the country. And so just keep that in mind as we're looking at some of these interventions. These are not things that require huge amounts of money. What they require is the audacity to try them, really. So we started first and foremost with community partnerships. And this included, you know, going out into the community and meeting with as many organizations as possible who are in any way addressing substance use disorders or seriously at-risk populations. Just solidifying those relationships and seeing not only what they do and what their approaches are, but sharing with them what our approaches are. And this helps in terms of you know, increasing the ease of a referral network, for example, when we know people and we can work on any barriers to access. It also, though, gave us the opportunity to gauge who out there is doing evidence-based practice. And with any of these meetings, whenever we got a sense that somebody maybe wasn't engaging in evidence-based practice, what we did is we offered them education. And we're not an academic institution, but we recognize that for the most part, when substance use disorder treatment is not being done, it's because there's just a lack of training and understanding behind it. And so we offered education and as a collaborative gesture with as many places as possible. Also, these community partnerships were not isolated to healthcare organizations. We also reached out to faith-based organizations and churches, et cetera, to give them education about how to recognize substance use disorders, how to speak to their congregants about substance use disorders and what resources are out there. So really very helpful. We also initially, through all these meetings, built our own treatment resource guide that we made available so that people could know where to go and where to send patients. And that's something that has evolved and something that we continue to do. Another big part of the initiative that we did was really see how can we enhance what's done in primary care. Since primary care is our largest workforce, we've really focused a lot on primary care doing a lot of this work because they are the front lines and because patients who are living with substance use disorders are accessing primary care in general more than any other part of the healthcare system, as is true with just about every disease entity. And so what we heard from primary care is that a lot of them were struggling with pain management. And this wasn't just opioid prescribing, although opioid prescribing was part of it. It was also, you know, what to do other than opioids. What are not, you know, opioid alternatives in terms of medications? What is available that is not a medication treatment of chronic pain? And so we really have focused a lot on improving their skills here. This includes a big educational piece. For example, we give talks on a quarterly basis going over the CDC guidelines on chronic opioid prescribing for chronic pain. We also built that into essentially a clinical practice guideline for our organization. And we also pair that talk with a talk on non-opioid analgesics, so medications and other treatments that can be used to treat pain that are alternatives to opioids. And we also give guidance in that on not only how to initiate chronic opioid therapy for those who want to do it, but how to do a really good risk assessment, situations to avoid so as not to contribute to harm inadvertently, right? How to respond and reduce the chances of accidental, a lethal overdose with opioids. And then also gave guidance on how to reduce and wean off of opioids in both a safe and a compassionate way. Because what we heard from so many providers is that they felt pretty comfortable with starting opioids, and they were really challenged with how to wean or discontinue them. So we provided them with that guidance and support. We also, through this process, for example, made some order sets in our electronic medical record that would just make it easier to implement treatment. Both for not only for pain management, but also for initiating medication-assisted treatment to actually treat the substance use disorders, as well as how to treat withdrawal, for example, alcohol withdrawal or opioid withdrawal. And we're currently working on now an order set to help people very easily wean patients off of benzodiazepines when that's what they want to do.
And this This is Brenda from with Presbyterian Espanol Hospital. We're one of the 9 hospitals within the Presbyterian system. I'm the chief executive at this hospital. I'm also a registered nurse. And I just wanted to add our experience with what Dr. Duhigg just talked about, the medication-assisted treatment. So when Dr. Duhigg brought out all of this, this new approach and treatment to our patients, what we experienced in the inpatients was treating the patient's withdrawals while they were in here as an inpatient, which was a significant change for us. It made the patients more comfortable. It eased the caring for those patients for the nurses, right? It was less of a fight. There was, patients were discharged on medication-assisted treatment with a follow-up appointment in our substance use disorder clinic, and there was an increased openness of patients who were willing to consider aftercare treatment, which was amazing. So back to Dr. Duhigg.
Yeah, and thank you for that, Brenda. And not a multi-million dollar proposition to implement, right? Just kind of
right.
A willingness.
Yes.
It turns out none of this substance use disorder treatment is rocket science, which is great. So some of the system enhancements I've already talked about, making these evidence-based order sets just to make it easy. I wanted to make it as simple as possible for providers to initiate treatment. And by making order sets that would allow them to just make a few clicks and give them some guidance, I hoped would help that. one of the other things that we are in the process of implementing now is universal screening. So we've been, you know, screening universally, as many or all of you have been, for example, for tobacco use, our biggest killer. And we're changing how we're screening for alcohol use so that we can better identify problematic alcohol use. And then what we will start doing within this next year is also screening universally for problem opioid use. That will be at all settings of care, so whether it's primary care or specialty care, ER, hospital. We really want to screen everybody for problem opioid use so that we can respond appropriately, whether they have an opioid use disorder or whether they need some education about how to take their prescribed opioid analgesics, or whether they need a naloxone rescue kit just in case, for example. One of the other things that we did, a part of this initiative, was to create what we call the Integrated Addictions Medicine Consultation Liaison Service. So this is a hospital-based consult service. We first built it in our hospital, our largest hospital in downtown Albuquerque. And it consisted of a physician who, in this case, was an internist who is boarded in addiction medicine, along with initially a nurse practitioner and a physician's assistant, as well as a peer support care coordinator. And that last team member is a really important part of this team. So just to describe in general, so if somebody is admitted to the hospital and identified as having either a substance use disorder or a possible substance use disorder, they can just order a consult, the primary team. They order an addiction consult, and this team comes and sees them. They assess them, and if there is a substance use disorder present, then they will initiate treatment or make recommendations about treatment. And then the second and equally, if not more important, part of what they do is they work really hard to set up a post-discharge plan. So, for example, if somebody comes in and they're identified as having an opioid use disorder and they think that it's appropriate for that patient to be on methadone maintenance therapy, then they will start them on methadone in the hospital and coordinate with the opioid treatment program or the methadone clinic so that the patient can access that clinic the day that they're discharged from the hospital. Likewise, if they start them on Suboxone, we set them up with a Suboxone provider. If they are being treated for alcohol use disorder with naltrexone or acamprosate, same thing. We set them up with an ambulatory provider who can provide the medications, but then also we are working to integrate them into a non-pharmacological treatment too, whether that's just getting them to go, encouraging them to go to 12-step meetings, or actually into, you know, an intensive outpatient program, et cetera. So there's a lot of that coordination at the time and in preparation for discharge with really kind of care coordination and discharge planning. It's a huge, huge piece of it. We then expanded this to another hospital in the Albuquerque area. And this service has been so successful, meaning that they're seeing so many patients, that fortunately in the last few months we then launched a second consult service in the northern region of the state. And they cover our Santa Fe hospital as well as our Española hospital. And that's a smaller team. It's a physician and the peer support care coordinator, so a two-person team. And we are in the process of finalizing our ability to use telehealth connections so they don't have to travel between Santa Fe and Española, these two cities, to see the patients, that they can kind of, you know, you spread that resource better. Brenda, do you want to comment at all on the impact of this team up in your hospital?
Yes. Adding to what I said, what our experience was before, when we first got started with the program, we actually didn't have the telemed piece. What we had was the peer support care coordinator here on campus 2 days a week. And since our length of stay is you know, around 3 days in the acute care, that allowed for that peer support care coordinator to go around on all those substance use disorder patients that were admitted and do an assessment and offer help, which was a game changer. I'm very passionate about improving the care of substance use disorder treatment and helping those patients. And probably in the last 10 years, if we offered help to our patients, you know, one or two said yes. And now we have 20, 30 people saying yes. I attribute that to making them comfortable while they're in the hospital and them seeing that there's hope that they can actually handle the treatment because they're actually feeling better with the treatment that we're giving them. And so, again, like Dr. Duhigg said, it doesn't cost a whole lot of money to get started. You can have support. You know, Albuquerque's about 80 miles from here. So our peer support care coordinator would go in and do the assessment and then call the physicians in Albuquerque, and they would start treatment in that way. So it didn't even have to be the telehealth piece.
Dr. Yeah, and it's thanks for those comments. It's also had a huge impact on the hospital staff. So from, you know, the other attendings and the other providers on other services, the hospitalists, they really feel supported. And, you know, from them and nursing as well, what we see is a real change in the experience of interacting with patients who are living with substance use disorders, because by you know, compassionately and also in a timely way addressing this aspect of their medical needs, we end up reducing a lot of the tensions that can coexist when a patient is seeking help but feels like this aspect of their health is not being addressed. So it's really been very positive all around. I mentioned education, and we do a significant amount of education. I talked about our CDC guideline talks and our non-opioid analgesic presentations. We also do a lot of trainings to certify providers to prescribe Suboxone. For anybody who doesn't know, you know, this is literally one of the safest medicines that we have, safer literally than aspirin, and is a very effective medicine for treating opioid use disorder, but unfortunately, a certification is required, and for physicians, that's 8 hours of training that you just need to do once, and then for physician's assistants and nurse practitioners, it's a total of 24 hours. And so we wanted to remove that barrier, so we provide that training for free, and we provide it. Initially, we provided it on a quarterly basis, and now we do it even more than quarterly, essentially whenever we can identify people who need it. We also have a variety of other talks, stigma busting, addictions 101, basics and fundamentals of medication-assisted treatment, et cetera. And then one of the other things that we've done is launched what are called echo clinics. And for anybody who's unfamiliar with these, this is really using video conferencing technology, but to get providers together and use case-based learning really reinforce standard of care and give people just-in-time guidance on patient care. It's a really neat model that was developed at the University of New Mexico and that we have adopted here. So over a year ago, we implemented our first Presbyterian Echo, which is a chronic pain, addiction, and mental health echo. And so on a weekly basis, people can connect and present real-life cases and get real feedback on that. On those cases. And again, really the biggest point of this is that it really helps people feel supported so that they can actually try this to implement treatment because they know that they can connect to me as an addiction psychiatrist and somebody with knowledge about chronic pain management or any of the other content experts that we have on. And so this is just talking about that. We have really good attendance, and one of the other great things about Echo, just like this webinar, how we are all in different places but can share this space, Echo is something that allowed it essentially eliminates geography. And so whether folks were in Albuquerque or in Española or in small rural towns across the state, we could all come together and then be on the same page about how to treat substance use disorders and approach to chronic pain. So it's been very, very helpful and a neat thing to be a part of. One of the more exciting programs that we are now just starting to launch is what we call the ED buprenorphine induction program. So buprenorphine is the medication that most of us know as Suboxone. And what we and many emergency departments across the country have been experiencing and noticing is that people will come in maybe after an opioid overdose, or they come in opioid withdrawal that's causing a lot of symptoms, or they come in with some other medical need, but opioid use disorder is part of what's going on. And what we have found is that a lot of people with pretty serious substance use disorders tends to only access healthcare when they are dying, when they're in need, and then they don't really benefit from longitudinal treatment. So it's been very hard to get them into treatment. So what we decided to do based on a study that was done at Yale that kind of proved that this could work is actually when we identify people with an opioid use disorder in the emergency department, offer them to start them on treatment with Suboxone right then and there, and then plug them into an ambulatory appointment with a Suboxone provider within 5 days so that we can really get them into treatment. And what the Yale study showed is that doing this, starting Suboxone or buprenorphine in the emergency department, did reduce the need for hospitalization, which is fantastic. That study, that analysis only went on for a month. So in that month, they could not show a reduction in emergency department repeat visits. But I anticipate that if they actually kept it going longer than a month, that is what they would see. And that's certainly what we're hoping here. And so we're actually launching this first in our Española hospital that Brenda runs, as well as our Santa Fe hospital. And we're really excited because we think that this is a game changer. It's going to save lives and also really save resource utilization.
And this is Brenda. I want to
better for everybody.
This is Brenda. I wanted to add that the way we're going to work in the follow-up visits is by not opening a separate clinic, it's to see those patients in our same-day clinic that already exists. And so we've said every Thursday morning we're going to see those patients for follow-up in a clinic that already exists.
Yeah, and really try to change the trajectory of how things have been done. So really excited. Another program that we've been developing is called opioid stewardship. This is really modeled on antimicrobial stewardship, but instead of focusing on antibiotics, focusing on opioid prescribing. And so, you know, it starts with standardizing opioid prescribing practices, just like antibiotic stewardship, and then we are now monitoring opioid use and prescribing across our system, and then essentially reaching out to anybody who falls out of that normal distribution and having a talk with them about, you know, what changes in their practice might be needed. And so this has been an exciting process, and we are too early in it to see, you know, kind of data outcome changes, but it's very wide-reaching, and I anticipate we're going to see benefits just like we have with antimicrobial stewardship. So, Brenda, I'd like to turn it over to you and anything else you'd like to add.
So what I would like to add is that our current experience is that we've also added Narcan to discharge for our ER patients. So we think that will decrease the amount of overdoses. So we've been doing that for about half a year. And we're going to add, like Dr. Duhigg talked about, Suboxone on discharge from the ER, so then they would get Narcan and Suboxone with a follow-up appointment in our substance use disorder clinic to be followed up. And then we're working with the Department of Health to fund They will be funding a peer support care coordinator 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in our emergency room. That's the plan. So we're very excited about continuously improving on this work.
Yeah, and just, you know, just to add, so for anybody who's not familiar with a peer support, because this is actually a technical term here, a peer in this case is somebody with lived experience. So this is not a licensed provider. This is not a medical provider. This is somebody who is well into their recovery from substance use disorders. And so what's been shown out there is that having a peer support worker as a part of the healthcare team makes a huge difference. And in kind of, I think, the simplest terms, this is somebody who can talk to the patient like a patient. I think in the best cases, somebody who understands their cultural background, who also understands local resources, but because of their lived experience and has been through it, what we find is that this tends to be somebody that the patient can relate to more easily than they can to a physician or an advanced practice a provider or clinician. And again, research has supported this by using peer support recovery specialists in emergency departments and in hospitals. It really augments the team in a great way. But what's also, I think there are two great things about peer support workers. On the one hand, because they are not medical professionals, these are not very expensive employees, and so there's a huge return on investment in that sense because they're not expensive, but they bring a ton of value. Also, though, I think what a great solution. So somebody who has kind of conquered this illness, right, and is well into their recovery, and then we're able to provide them now with a job where they're able to not only prosper themselves, but they are literally helping their community as well. It's really a win-win for everybody, and an exciting new role in healthcare.